causality correlation entails for systemic risk measurement. So this is a new research project that I was introduced actually last Friday, and so it's quite fresh, but I think it has substantial interest both from an econometric and a economic point of view. About a year ago, we introduced the VLAB at NYU, which is a volatility laboratory to show different kind of volatility models. Originally, we just had a small number of assets, and now we've got, you know, several hundred assets in all these different kinds of sectors. And what I'm doing today is introducing basically a new set of analyses for the VLAB, which we call the risk page. And this is a measure of the systemically most risky companies in the financial sector in the U.S. We have 100 companies basically that we follow data on, and we look at measures of risk for these companies and measures of systemic risk that we've developed in a collaborative research project at NYU. The idea is that these are based on market data so that they do not require looking at companies' books and cross listings and so forth, and obviously therefore are not going to be as detailed and accurate as you would be able to have by careful study of proprietary information at these companies, but would give a good way of screening and deciding which kinds of assets, which kind of companies ought to be subject to more intense scrutiny. So what do we mean by systemic risk? Well, we've talked a great deal about systemic risk now because it's been so important in this financial crisis, and it's such an important part of legislative proposals. It's essentially a question of what are the externalities in the risk-taking environment that lead to risks being not all borne by the companies that take them, but some of the risks are spread to other parts of the economy. Daniel Tarullo's definition is rather nice. He talks about how a company, if it fails to meet its obligations to either customers or creditors, would have significant adverse impacts on the economy as a large. So how do we measure systemic risk? And what is the essence of the econometric problem here? We are going to talk about estimating something called marginal expected shortfall, which we're going to develop a new sort of econometric methodology for, and then apply this to the problem of defining systemically risky companies. So in a financial crisis, we can think about companies as having massive losses. These losses basically are to both stockholders and bondholders in all companies, and in crisis, these represent basically the loss to the economy as a whole. And the question is, which firms have the biggest losses in a crisis? Which firms would we expect to have the largest losses in a future crisis? And that's what we're trying to get at. So we're going to try to extrapolate data from non-crisis periods to talk about crises. And obviously that's a very dangerous thing to try to do, so we're going to have to be a little bit careful about how we do it. But the idea is we're going to look at the equity losses that a firm might expect from less than a crisis, and then use that information to figure which companies are likely to do worst in a full-blown future crisis. The externalities from one firm to another are from the losses in one firm are essentially coming from defaults or inadequate capital of this company. When the stock price falls low enough, there are capital shortages. These capital shortages impose costs on creditors beyond this company, and that's the sort of externality argument that is behind this. So let's start by talking about the fundamental econometric object we're interested in, this marginal expected shortfall. You probably all know the standard risk measure called expected shortfall, which is the expectation of the losses or the returns of a company. In this case, we're going to think about it as the market as a whole, conditional on the market being more negative than some fairly negative value. Just to fix your concentration, we're going to think about 2% market declines as the event we're going to measure here. And so we are used to the idea of how do you measure the expected loss given that the market declines by 2%. This is a useful and coherent measure of risk. But it also can be decomposed in the nice way by recognizing that the market is, of course, a weighted average of components. We can talk about what is the expected loss of each of the components of an index in the same crisis. And because of the additivity and linearity of conditional expectations, this follows immediately. And we define the marginal expected shortfall as the loss on one company's stock given that the market is going down by 2%. So we want to know which companies have the biggest losses when the market is going down. And we treat this as the econometric issue that we're trying to measure. But on top of that, of course, there is a little bit of algebra and work to translate this into a systemic risk measure. So the model is basically to say that the return on the market is this conditional variance or conditional standard deviation times some innovation. And the return on the individual stock can be written as its conditional standard deviation times its innovation. But that innovation is partly correlated with the market innovation and partly uncorrelated with it. And the correlation coefficient at time t is rho t, or at least the predicted correlation is rho t, then we can always write it in this form. And so this is the same epsilon m. This is a separate random variable, which is not necessarily independent of this one, but is uncorrelated with it, conditionally uncorrelated with it. And what the assumption we're going to make is that this joint distribution of the epsilon m and ci is independent of over time. They're each going to have conditional variance 1, conditional covariance 0, but may be dependent. There may be tail dependence between these two series that we're going to want to take into account. So how do we build a model that looks like this? Well, the parts of this are fairly standard. We're going to use asymmetric Gartsch models for both the idiosyncratic variance and the market variance. We're going to use an asymmetric DCC model to model the correlations between these two, where we have one term which depends on the cross product of returns, another term which depends on the cross product of returns when they're both negative. And we do, these stars indicate that we're using this Ioli correction, which is one of the sort of niceties of DCC. But this is a bivariate problem. We're doing it with the market return and each stock one at a time. So then, based on these things, the marginal expected shortfall can be written by substituting in our expression for the individual return into that definition. And so we end up with sigma I times rho I times the expectation as of time t minus 1 of the market innovation, given that the market innovation is less than this value C divided by sigma. And so you can see that the marginal expected shortfall depends on the volatility of the individual company and its correlation, multiplicatively on those two, and then it depends on what is essentially the expected shortfall of the market. But then there's a second term. And the second term is kind of an interesting second term, which is also sigma I squared of 1 minus rho squared times the expectation of this Ci variable, given that the market is less than some is in its tail. And this whole term would be zero if these things were independent. But we're not going to assume they're independent. We're going to assume that they are potentially have some kind of tail dependence and could influence the return on the stock on one asset when the market is in its extreme tail. So how do we estimate these two tail probabilities? Well, a natural way to estimate them is just a simple non-parametric procedure. So we can look for this one at all the observations where epsilon m is less than some constant that would be chosen for each day separately. And therefore, you could do the average of them over this day, over the number of days that are in this tail. And that's a way of estimating that first tail probability. Similarly, we could estimate the Ci given epsilon m is in its tail, again, as a simple average of the residuals that are in this in the during this extreme tail moments. There's a fair amount of noise when you do that because some of these tail events are pretty uncommon, so that it makes sense to smooth these estimates. And so what we've done is we've done a kernel smoother of these probabilities. So therefore, basically, we're calculating them at various probabilities, both to the left and to the right of the actual threshold that we want, and we smooth those. It makes the results a little bit nicer. And so here's what the tail would look like for different thresholds, and this is what the smooth one looks like. And so that's what we're going to report are the smooth ones. We're going to use an unbalanced panel of 102 large U.S. financial firms in four industry groups, depository institutions, insurance, security and commodity brokers, and others. We use a market index and quarterly data from CompuStat on the quasi-leverage of each of these companies. And if you look at the average returns of these four groups of companies over the sample period, you see that the securities and commodities brokers in black have this great run-up and great decline. The other group, which includes a lot of real estate organized type functions, you know, the GSEs are in there, and real estate brokers and various other financial institutions were next. Then we have the banks and insurance companies are actually the slowest growing in this period. The bottom, I believe, is the market average. And so if you look at the average parameter estimates in each of these groups, they look fairly familiar from individual Garch estimation methods and DCC estimation methods. And if you look at the here's the volatility across industries, and you see these big spikes in the security and commodity brokers, which are associated with the really peaks of the crisis. I mean, I guess this is the summer of 2000. No, wait, let's see. This is fall of 2007. Here, this is, I think, Bear Stearns. And here we have Lehman when they all go up together. Correlations over time don't vary too much. And if you look at a plot of the values of the MES in July of 2007, so this is really just before we think of the crisis as starting, which is probably August 2007, you can the black ones are these commodity and securities brokers. And so here's Bear Stearns up here, one of the highest. Here's Lehman. Here's Merrill Lynch and Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, Citibank, Freddie, Fannie is in here somewhere. AIG is down further. They're not they don't show up so high on this ranking. But basically, it does a pretty good job of picking out the most vulnerable firms and the ones that did actually do the worst in this crisis. If you look third quarter of 2008, you see actually the GSEs have moved up to top billing, Freddie and Fannie, and AIG has gotten up there. Here's Merrill Lynch. So again, we see a pretty good representation of the firms that we most worry about. Does this measure have any corroboration that we can see in the data? Well, any day that the market goes down by 2% or more, we could look at these 100 companies and see whether the ones that we predicted were going to do the worst did do the worst, and whether the ones that had the smallest MES would actually suffer the least from this day. So what we one thing we look at is the rank correlation between the MES the day before a crisis, before a 2% decline, and the actual decline of these companies on the next day. And we do that one day ahead or multi-days ahead to see how much predictability there really is in it. And here's just a quick set of numbers. These are the rank correlations on each of the days of 2% decline in the U.S. over the period 95 to, I guess, the end of 2009 approximately. And so basically, the rank correlations are mostly above 0.2. They sometimes get as high as 0.6 or 0.7. And so it does a pretty good job of ranking companies by the losses that are expected to happen on the succeeding time frame. There are a couple of other measures of success, but this gives you the flavor that, in fact, this is an object that we can validate using the criteria that we set up to estimate it. So what do we end up putting on this risk page? Well, the first thing we put on is a plot of what the average MES is for these 100 companies on each day. And it changes every day, so we have a picture here. And you remember, this is how much will the stock price go down on the average financial stock when the market goes down by 2%. And so on this axis, it's in percent, and you see that at the end of this period, it's about 3.5% that you would expect an average financial company to go down when the market goes down by 2%. But back up here in the crisis period, fall of 08 and spring of 09, and actually a lot of the financial crisis was worst in the spring of 09, it was good bit higher, 7% maybe, suggesting these companies move very strongly with financial, with the aggregate market return. If you look at the leaders on this list, Ambach is, I think, the highest, was on Friday the highest anyway, and here is its MES compared with the average. We just saw a picture of the average, and what you see is that it shoots up here right at the end of the sample period to being an enormous 20%. Well, it turns out this is a company, this is a monoline insurer, big trouble. They're being taken over by Wisconsin regulators, and the equity investors are likely to be lose everything. So it's very sensitive to the underlying market moves. And but does that mean it's systemically risky? It's not so obvious because it's small. We know that it's a problem. And does it have capital shortfall? That is what we have to calculate. You know, how do you translate this into capital shortages? If you look this week at Goldman, you see a similar thing that Goldman, which actually was fairly low on this list, more or less average, but on Friday, of course, had the SEC announcement, and we see by Monday, when we look at the Friday's data, its estimated MES has shot up because the Goldman volatility has gone up as well as the correlation estimator. So how do we calculate the actual rankings? What we do is we say, okay, this is what the equity should go down in a if the market goes down by 2%. But what would it go down if the market went down by 40% over 6 months? So we have to infer that. And the way we do it is a little ad hoc at the moment, but it's not that different from simulating a whole bunch of paths with the DCC and the Garches going, and then looking at the trajectory of the paths that have worse than a 40% decline, and seeing what these sectors did. So those are the paths that have the highest volatility and the highest correlations, it will turn out, and we get an estimate of what would happen to the stock price. We compare that with what that does to the leverage of the company, and if we think that there is some prudential capital ratio that you want to have, capital to value of assets, then we can measure the shortfall in capital each company has. This is pretty much the way the stress test was done by the Federal Reserve. And the net effect is we get a sum of shortages of capital across the whole economy, and we can see which company would be the most biggest contributor to that capital shortfall. And here's the top 10. Number one is Bank of America. Number two is Citigroup. Then we have number three is Goldman Sachs, jumping up from seventh spot last week to third spot this week. Morgan, Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae, AIG, Morgan Stanley, Prudential, and Hartford Financial Services Group. So some of the insurance companies are showing up here, and I guess, of course, AIG. These three, and probably Citigroup, we already think of as wards of the government. So what are they doing on this list? Well, I think the argument is that if the government guarantees were taken away, this would be a systemic crisis for the economy. So that's why they're on there. This list is on the website. I encourage you to take a look at it. It's going to be updated, I guess probably weekly for a few weeks till we make sure it's making sense, and then we're going to update it daily. And the idea is that this is kind of a way of committing to some methodology and seeing how it works out. And it's kind of a scientific experiment to see whether we can say something interesting and perhaps help this regulatory debate go forward. Thank you.
We should take questions at the coffee break.
Okay, good. Should I pull the pin, or you want to do something with it?
Okay, it's right here, actually.
Okay, so the title has changed with respect to the program, but the paper has not changed. It sounds like the title was not sufficiently clear. So now we make explicit in the title that we have a duration model which is based on a heating time model. But from the very beginning, I'm going to stress that we think that this model is structural for the following reason is that it is based on latent variables. And the goal is to give some structural foundation, in particular for the kind of ACD model, which has been introduced by Rob with Jeff Russell. The advantage to be structural is that it gives us some flexibility to have joint model for duration and prices, including possibly multiple asset issues. So the goal is to encompass this kind of model, which are popular in the literature, but with some latent framework, which allows us to build some model. So Clearly, this outline is too long for 20 minutes, but I will do my best. So after motivating, I would like to think about duration for one asset, then prices for one asset, because the goal is to have a joint model for duration and prices, and some how can you have analytical formula for likelihood, then some extension to multiple assets, and a very little preliminary empirics. Okay. So the goal is to analyze events which occur at random times. So a duration model is typically a model which tells you what is the probability distribution in a dynamic way of the duration between two events. And the reason why we need a structural approach is that first, we want a joint duration price model, and which we can understand as a different kind of correlation between duration and prices. Typically, if you think about duration between transactions and prices, which are, for instance, the mid quotes at the transaction time, there should be correlation between them. Another reason why it's fine to have this kind of structural framework is that if you are asking me now what is the probability distribution of not of the duration from one transaction to another, but I have observed a transaction 5 seconds ago, what is the probability distribution of the remaining duration? Okay. If you have no latent framework as we build, you are in trouble to answer this question. And also, if you want to have some multiple asset issues. And, you know, we have a recent forthcoming journal paper with Bas Verker where we are focusing on the causality relationship between duration and volatility. So some, for some aspect, we want a structural model for that. And a byproduct of that is that it will give us way to encompass and so to have some specification testing of a bunch of popular models, novodels for these issues. Okay. So let me introduce the framework. So we call it a multiple asset dynamic mixed heating time model because there is that idea that we have an increasing sequence of observation time, which you may think about transaction times, for instance, which are stopping times for continuous time filtration. And then you have, at these times, you observe some prices. So which are adapted to this filtration. Okay. And so let me first build the model for one duration. Okay. So the idea is the following, is to think, this is a very popular framework actually in stochastic calculus, to think about heating time of a Brownian motion. That is to say, let us think that if you are at time TR, you want to think about the time of the next event, you are going to say that there is some linear process plus some drift hitting some barrier. Okay. This is going to define the next time. Okay. And you know, you can put some dynamic in that because you can think that both the drift and the barrier depend on past information. This is the reason why you have a sub TI, because everything depends on past information. Okay. If you build a duration like that, the heating time of a Brownian motion is something very well known in the literature. It is actually the distribution is an inverse Gaussian. And so the inverse Gaussian, so in this case you have an inverse Gaussian with mean is the ratio of the value of the barrier divided by the value of the drift. And you have another parameter for the inverse Gaussian, which is going to characterize the variance as a whole. And so basically we know the Laplace transform in a very simple form for the inverse Gaussian. So it is going to be the Laplace transform we are going to work with. So it is a conditional Laplace transform of the next duration given. So the next duration given the time TI, the information time TI. Okay. So in particular for this inverse Gaussian, we know the mean, we know the variance, and we know all the moments exist. And basically the reason why all the moments exist is that you assume that the drift is strictly positive. Okay. In a former version of this paper, you know, we because the points you have to, you know, you want to think that duration have finite expectation in particular. So either you put the positive drift or another way to get it, where the former version of this paper is to think about an exit time with an interval with two barriers. It turns out that we realize that we have a more tractable model with introduce just one barrier and a positive drift. And now another issue is that we like to have more flexibility in the probability distribution of duration. We don't want to remain stuck with inverse Gaussian distribution. Inverse Gaussian distribution are nice, but maybe you want to have other distributions. So one way to get it is to think that with mixture of inverse Gaussian, you can get a lot. And the way to get mixture of inverse Gaussian remaining structural is to put the mixture component in the value of the boundary and the drift. Okay? That is to say, the reason why it is called the mixed ticking time model is that now you have some mixing variable, let me call M, N, and N, which enter the value of the barrier and the value of the drift. And so I put a tilde now to stress that this barrier and this drift are stochastic. Okay? So now, given this mixing variable, I have inverse Gaussian, but at the end of the day, my observable distribution for duration will be this mixture of inverse Gaussian, which is quite flexible framework. Okay. It's easy to realize that you encompass the popular model. If you think in particular of the so-called stochastic conditional duration model, which has been introduced by Bowens and Veredas, basically the idea is that all the dynamics go through the conditional mean. But a conditional mean which may depend on some latent variable of this mixing variable, typically. Okay? So if you want, in our case, that all the dynamics go through the mean, basically you have to impose that the conditional variance given the mixing variable does not depend on the past. So basically it is a constraint of your drift and your barrier. You need that the product of the drift and the barrier does not depend on the past. If you are in this case, you are in the SCD case where all the dynamics go through the conditional mean. So we have a model which encompasses SCD as a particular case. Now, if you think about SCD, which has been introduced by Rob and Jeff Russell, you have a condition more because now not only all the dynamics go through the mean, but by contrast with the SCD, when Bowens and Veredas say SCD, they had in mind that you may have some exogenous processes. And so it is stochastic conditional duration. The SCD framework is typically a case where you have all the dynamics go through the conditional expectation given past observable observation. You no longer introduce the latent variable N and N, right? So in this case, you have an additional restriction within the SCD. And so typically, you can characterize SCD case as a case where, in some respect, really speaking, you can think about this way. All the dynamics, both in mu tilde and c tilde, both in the drift and in the barrier, all the dynamics go through the mean, and on top of that, the two dynamics compensate each other in the product. Okay, so this is a way to characterize SCD within SCD, SCD being itself a particular case of our model. So you have restrictions you can test, you know, testable restrictions about the dynamics of the conditional variant, typically. Now, what about the model for prices? The goal is to think that prices and duration should be correlated. That is to say, you know, you have the intuition that when you observe more transactions on the market, it tells you something about news related to the price, right? The way we do it is the following. We define an asset price process basically as a geometric Brownian motion, but a geometric Brownian motion between two dates. Okay, so it does not preclude conditional heteroscedasticity, time varying correlation, whatever you want. But these things are fixed at the beginning of the period when you observe Ti, and you keep it between Ti and Ti plus one. And on top of that, you introduce some correlation with duration because you remember that duration are defined by the fact that the Brownian motion W is hitting some barrier. So you have a raw coefficient here, which tells you that how much the variation of the price is correlated to the variation to the duration. But through this latent process, this is the reason why it's quite flexible, because everything goes through this latent process. And you have an independent component in the price itself. So at the end of the day, we do something which is maybe has been done by the first time by Rob in his Econometrica 2000 paper, which is to characterize the conditional distribution of the return given not only past information but also current duration. If you do this, you have a distribution given current duration which is a normal, but you have to realize that we have more flexibility than normal because it is actually a mixture of normal given this mixing variable M and N. But given M and N, you have a normal with a conditional expectation and a conditional variance. And you see, of course, that the correlation coefficient matters This is the guys will tell you that some correlation between duration and price chance, right? So typically, if you put rho equals zero, you realize that the expectation by unit of time and the variance by unit of time is constant over the interval, like in a geometric Brownian motion. Okay? This is this rho coefficient which makes the difference, which makes the correlation between price change and duration. Okay. So you can think about this instantaneous relationship that we had studied before with Bass-Werker. Of course, since it is a mixture of normal, you can play with whatever kind of skewness or future kurtosis you want. The mixture of normal gives us this flexibility. Another important thing for manipulation is the following, is that this normal we get, right, you realize that it was both the mean and the variance was linear with respect to the duration. So it means that if you think about the Laplace transform, you have an exponential of something linear with respect to the duration. So a nice byproduct of that is that if you think now about the joint distribution of duration and price changes, since this guy, if I condition over the duration, this guy would be exponentially linear with respect to the duration. From the Laplace transform of the duration that I know, because it is a mixture of inverse Gaussian. From the Laplace transform of the duration, I get this joint distribution in closed form, in terms of Laplace transform. Okay. Initially, we are very excited with that, and we tried to do some GMM inference since we have this in closed form. Actually, it did not work that well. If you think of the kind of data, you have nice frequency data. So we went back to likelihood, even though we have this in closed form. So if somebody wants to try, you can. It's a nice closed form, but the estimation results are a bit disappointing. You know, to use the Laplace transform is not so easy because you have to use a grid of values and all that. By the way, so we went to likelihood formula, and we had a nice surprise, I would say, that we have also closed form for likelihood. The density of an inverse Gaussian is well known, right? It is this. Now we have some mixing variable. Actually, we simplify our life. We put the mixing only in the barrier, not on the drift. We could, but, you know, just to as a first try. For the mixing variable, we take an half normal, okay, a normal truncated to be positive, okay, because the mixing variable shows up multiplicatively in the barrier, right? You want a positive barrier, right? So we want something with the reason why we take a half normal rather than a standard positive density like a gamma, whatever you want, is that we want a lot of mass at zero because we observe a lot of very small duration, a lot of mass close to zero, right? So we take an half normal like that. And the nice thing is that now we have to marginalize, right, to integrate over the mixing variable. And the nice thing is work well. Let's say we have closed form formula now for the density of the duration given past information by mixing the inverse Gaussian with this half norm. First thing. Second thing, we have now to define the dynamics of this guy. And typically, you know, when I've said STD by reference to the Ungern and Rosser paper 1998, there was two things in this paper. There was one thing which was saying that the dynamics goes through the conditional expectation. So we have said that we have this as a particular case. Second thing, now, how do you give the dynamics of this conditional expectation? How do you specify it? The nice thing in this paper by Rob and Jeff is that they use a kind of Gauss-1-1 specification for expected duration. But when you think about expected duration, basically you think about the ratio of our barrier divided by drift. Okay, so you can think about directly this kind of Gauss-1-1 on that. And if you come back to the duration, you realize that the persistence on duration will be given by that. So it has to be smaller than one. Okay. Okay. Now, the most difficult part of the likelihood story, in some respect, is to marginalize to get the distribution of price changes given duration. Because given the mixing variable, we have a normal which means that. But now we have to integrate over the mixing variable, and which is not so simple because by definition, the mixing variable is not independent of the duration because this is duration are defined by that. But you have the Bayes formula, which gives us the probability distribution of the duration given, of the mixing variable given the duration. Okay? So basically, you have to integrate that with this density that we get from the Bayes formula, and we get a closed form again. So everything is going well. So we have the likelihood in closed form. 2 minutes, okay. So of course, we have to go, I have to speed up. So we have the standard empirical issues. I have no time to say, but first you have, of course, to take into account intraday seasonality. You have to take into account the fact that price in that frequency is rather difficult to see them as continuous variables. Actually, we did both. If we discretize, we have to think at a kind of ordered probit model. It complicates a lot, and it does not change significantly the result. So we are back to the continuous setting. Just to mention that we can extend this to multiple assets by just saying that there is a common Brownian motion which defines the duration, which is going to be correlated with this price. Each price has its own Brownian motion, and you have just to take a minimum of the barrier over k asset to have all the events regarding the k asset. And it is internally consistent thanks to the fact that the Brownian motion has independent increment. If you add an asset, you do not change the kind of model, right? So preliminary empirics, very, very fast. We take one stock, Pepsi bottling group, average duration something like 11 seconds, and so on and so on. I have no time to go into the details, just some estimators to show you that something exists. So first, the mixed thing variable, which is half normal, is really concentrated on the zero value to take account a large number of small durations. Second, the persistence of duration is high, which is not a surprise. And last, the correlation coefficient is positive. The correlation coefficient between the Brownian motion, which defines the duration, and the prices. It sounds like it corresponds to something which has been noted by Rob in several papers, is that expected returns are lower when you have longer durations. And Rob has related this to some microstructure theory by Diamond Verger and so on. So I have not elaborated, but it's so that we find something which is nice. And I will conclude on that. It turns out that it is a parametric complement to some work we had done before, which was on the one hand semi-parametric or on the other hand non-parametric. So some respect, we fill the gap. Okay, thank you.